This program is made possible with grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts, because a great nation deserves great art. Additional funds from Saul and Stanley Zabar in memory of their parents, Louis and Lillian Zabar, Russian immigrants who founded Zabar's more than 70 years ago. Zabar's, a New York landmark, supplies food and delicacies to New Yorkers and to the nation, on the web at zabars.com. Additional support from Edwin A. Goodman, Harvey and Thelma Reisman, the John L. Loeb Jr. Foundation, from Frost, Zelnick, Lehrman, and Zissou, specializing in intellectual property law for clients worldwide, on the web at frostzelnick.com, and from one anonymous donor.
This is Over the Rainbow, the story of the Jews who created Tin Pan Alley and Hollywood, Part 2. It's part of the series Only in America, 350 Years of the American Jewish Experience. I'm Larry Josephson. The movie industry took off at the turn of the century in the hands of half a dozen ambitious Jewish immigrants. They've come to be known as the moguls.
Once in a lullaby.
They all came from within 500 miles of each other in Eastern Europe. All came to America within 5 years of each other. All moved to New York and went into businesses largely in and around the garment business.
A. Scott Berg is Samuel Goldman's biographer. Goldman was born Shmuel Geldfish in Warsaw. After immigrating to the United States, he was a glove salesman before he turned to the movies.
In New York, two of the most successful of these guys were Adolf Zukor and William Fox. Fox later went on to create the studio, which we now know as 20th Century Fox, and Zukor founded the studio that eventually became Paramount.
My name is Adolf Zukor. When I came to this country, it was in 1888. I was not quite 16 years. At the end of 1903, then I took and rented a building which I intended to fix up for a moving picture theater, Nickelodeon. And that's the way the picture business developed.
There was no way these Jews right off the boat could become overnight successes in the banking business. But here was a new industry, one especially in which Gentiles had second thoughts about.
It was more colorful. It was just like a new discovery. People flocked to.
Every girl, a handsome looker, had a dance with Mr. Zucker. Mr. Thomas in stepped around just like a prince.
All these Jewish moguls deeply, truly believed in the American dream. And the amazing thing is that they found a business in which they could literally manufacture the American dream.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet. Wait a minute, I tell you.
Al Jolson was one of the biggest stars of the 1920s and 30s. His first movie was The Jazz Singer. It was a big hit, produced in 1927 by the Warner Brothers. The Jazz Singer was the first talkie, the first full-length feature produced with sound.
Remember, it wasn't really a full talking picture. It was only sound every other sequence. You know, it was only half sound and the other half was silent.
Samson Raphaelson from a 1959 oral history. His stage play, The Atonement, was adapted for the film.
They had a minimum of sound. They just had a little dialogue at one time. It was mainly the songs.
The Jazz Singer is overtly Jewish. It features Yossele Rosenblatt, the most famous cantor of the time. He plays a cantor in the film. Al Jolson plays the cantor's son who wants to be a jazz singer. against his father's wishes.
What interested me was the ancient religious sense of God and music and prayer and emotional melancholy that represented the Jew in the synagogue, and how it was in the young fellow, but conditioned by America, how it broke out in jazz.
I never saw the sun shining so bright, never saw things going so right, noticing the day, hurrying by, when you're in love, oh, don't it fly?
To me, it was always a play about the older generation and the young, radical, broken away from faith, from church, from synagogue, American generation, the baseball playing, the street boy, the pool room boy, the whole atmosphere was changing. So I felt it was a universal theme and that people would respond that way.
Al Jolson is, in a way, the model or the ego ideal for all the moguls. And the jazz singer was inspired by him.
Jay Hoberman is senior film critic at The Village Voice. He's the co-author of Entertaining America, Jews, Movies, and Broadcasting.
It was a version of his story and all these incredible scenes where his father, the cantor, wants him to come back. And he says, no, my songs mean as much to my audience as your prayers do to your congregation. And, you know, he's really standing up for this new American system, this new religion of America. And that was something that the moguls certainly could identify with. And when Warner Brothers made the movie, they really recognized that this was their story.
There was a complicated racial equation because Jolson and many other Jewish singers, comedians, appeared in blackface, which was humiliating to blacks. And Jews, being victims of prejudice, were essentially making fun of black people.
Yes, sir. They're playing married. I hope you remember it. The sun shines east, the sun shines west. I know where the sun shines best. Mammy, my little mammy, my heart's the rings are tangled around Alabama.
Blackface has a long and complicated history in American show business. It's the oldest indigenous American showbiz trope. Jewish performers, and to a lesser degree Italian performers, began using blackface in the early part of the 20th century for the same reason that the Irish had in the late 19th century, and that was because paradoxically it made them more American. They were putting on this mask. They were adopting American racial attitudes, and they were demonstrating in a way, too, that they were white, which is by no means taken for granted. When immigrants came here, they were regarded as belonging to another race.
Listen, I'm going to sing this like I will if I go on the stage, you know, with this show. I'm going to sing it jazzy. Now get this. Blue sky, smiling at me, 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 me. Nothing but little blue sky. Do I see? Do, 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 do.
Did Sam Goldwyn or any of the other Jewish moguls practice the Jewish religion, or did they throw it off?
Most of them. The only time there was any Jewish presence was when they got married or when they died.
A. Scott Berg, Samuel Goldwyn's biographer.
There was an interesting episode, however, in Samuel Goldwyn's life, and it was when his brother died, and Sam Goldwyn went to the funeral with his son. And they're sitting there, and as they get to the end of the funeral, and out of Sam Goldwyn's mouth, not reciting, but singing the Kaddish, and his son just looked up at his father with astonishment. He had never heard anything like this come from his father. And to this day, he hasn't figured out how he knew the words, how he knew the song. And yet he did. And for all these men, they did have it buried within them. And I've heard many a tale of the moguls' funerals in which it would come out. And they would all don their yarmulkes, and they would sob their eyes out. And then they would go back to being their mogul selves.
Then there's another phenomenon which many of, though not all of the moguls, divorced their Jewish wives and married Gentile wives.
Goldwyn was rather typical of his fellow moguls. He divorced his first wife, Blanche Lasky, and he did marry a woman named Frances Howard, who was much younger than he, was Catholic, who insisted that their son be raised Catholic. I think there were several reasons these Jewish moguls did that. I think they were attracted, first of all, to the kinds of women who had long been forbidden. in American culture, we grow up with this notion that blondes are more beautiful.
Is that your own hair, or did you scalp an angel?
That's largely because the movies have told us they're more beautiful. And that's because these Jewish moguls, when growing up, never saw a blonde woman. But suddenly, they had blondes thrusting themselves at them. So they could do that. And I think all this manifests itself in the films and in their lives.
Don't you know that a man being rich is like a girl being pretty? You might not marry a girl just because she's pretty. But my goodness, doesn't it help?
Louis B. Mayer, late in life, divorced his first wife and married a Gentile woman. Jack Warner was married to a Gentile. Part of the reason, I think, also, these Jewish moguls, in some ways, were trying to bleach away their Jewishness. And I'm not necessarily sure that it came out of shame of being Jewish so much as all the opportunity that would be open to them if they could pass as otherwise. And this became an issue into the late 40s and early 50s. They were really forced to declare their identities. Were they all American or were they Jewish?
I'm stepping out, my dear, to breathe an atmosphere that simply reeks with class. And I trust that you'll excuse my dust when I step on the gas. For I'll be there, putting down my top hat, mussing up a white tie, dancing in my tail.
Now we want to talk about how the Jewish background of not only the moguls, but the writers and the producers and the directors, many of whom, but not all, were Jewish, how those influenced the films they made.
To see Jewish content in the movies is a tricky proposition. In the early days, pre-Hollywood, the Nickelodeon days, there would be movies with Jewish themes because Jews were a significant part of the audience, even into the 20s. But that disappeared with the coming of sound very quickly. There would be, you know, some comic characters with Yiddish accents and so on. But the studios were not interested in making movies about Jews as Jews. I mean, they also were not interested in promoting their stars in terms of their ethnicity. So a number of Jewish stars changed their names routinely. Tony Curtis was Bernie Schwartz. Sylvia Sidney was Sylvia Russo. Paul Muni was Muni Weisenfreund. Edward G. Robinson was Emanuel Goldenberg. All the Jewish actors had to change their names.
Do you know what her name is? Esther Victoria Blodgett.
Hey, we'll have to do something about that right away.
Let's see, Esther Victoria, Victoria. Vicky, how about Vicky?
Oh, I think that's terribly cute.
Let's see, Vicky. Vicky what? See, Esther Hester Dester Lester. Vicky Lester.
Oh, I like that.
Say it.
Vicky Lester.
Say it again.
Vicky Lester.
It was certainly nothing new for actors to change their names. Indeed, Mary Pickford was Gladys Smith from Canada. So there was often good reason just to make one's name more euphonious, if nothing else. There were very few exceptions in the early days. I know there was a silent screen star who was very popular named Carmel Myers, who was the daughter of a rabbi. And they begged her to change her name, and she just wouldn't do it.
Ihr meigt mir gleich nother name. Nar ich sogar has a soyes dus gewein.
How much of the Yiddish theater influenced Jewish actors starting from the Yiddish theater into Hollywood in that period? How waspy did they become? Someone like Paul Muni, John Garfield.
Paul Muni is the major crossover from Yiddish theater to Hollywood. He was a real dynamo in New York in the 20s when he was on the Yiddish stage under the name Muni Weisenfreund. When he went to Hollywood, he changed his name. And he took roles where he had to act. And very often, he played ethnics. He played Benito Juarez. He played Louis Pasteur. I mean, he played a number. He never played a Jewish character, but he played everything else. He became a star playing a version of Al Capone in Scarface.
I suppose you didn't kill Louis Castillo.
Who, me? That's very funny. Big Louis and me, we're like this.
Castillo hired you for a bodyguard. Where were you at the shooting?
I was having my beauty sleep.
Where?
In the lady's house. You want her name? Phone number? She's very nice.
John Garfield, who was a little bit younger, was, in a way, the first Jewish matinee idol in the movies, although it's unclear whether he was recognized as Jewish by anybody other than Jews. But certainly there was a Jewish audience for him. And Garfield had been a tough street kid, and he played that type for Warner's in the 40s. It was clearly an urban type, maybe Jewish. I mean, he played a Jew in Gentleman's Agreement, but he had this very urban, street smart persona, and he was something new in movies when he appeared.
We can't leave the subject of Jewish performers without talking about the Marx Brothers, who slipped a whole lot of not only Yiddish but Jewish humor into their scripts in the Captain Spaulding Patter song.
Did someone call me Schnorrer?
Did someone call me Schnorrer, which means beggar, or in this case, moocher?
The Marx Brothers had a long and fruitful apprenticeship in vaudeville, and they were very successful on Broadway in the late 20s, and they went directly from Broadway to the movies. I don't think that they thought of themselves particularly as Jewish performers. It's more the perception of critics and audiences and historians that all kinds of Jewish attributes can be read into the Marx Brothers, and specifically into their humor and the wordplay and the disrespect for authority and the fact that they cast themselves always as outsiders. They're not part of the American elite. For these reasons, the Marx Brothers seem to be quintessentially Jewish.
Now, here are the contracts. You just put his name at the top and you sign at the bottom.
Why does this say here, this thing here?
That just says, if any of the parties participating in this contract are shown not to be in their right mind, the entire agreement is automatically nullified.
Well, I don't know.
It's all right. That's in every contract. That's what they call a sanity clause.
You can't fool me. There ain't no sanity clause.
One character you bring out in your book that never occurred to me as a Jewish character was Betty Boop.
Betty Boop was a very popular cartoon character of the early 30s who was created by Max and Dave Fleischer, who were immigrant Jewish brothers who ran a cartoon studio in New York. And theirs was the most ethnic cartoon studio, full of jazz musicians and Yiddish gags, much more anarchic and crazy than the Disney cartoons of the period. And Betty was their star. And she was modeled on a 20s singer, Helen Kane, the Boop Boop Doop girl. But somehow when she went into the cartoons, she became more ethnic. She got these Yiddish-speaking parents in one movie.
Und und don't you sabraten, Betty!
Und wenn I must once more tell you to eat.
She seems to understand Yiddish, or she's not surprised when she goes to the South Seas and they say, Shalom Aleichem, Betty.
Ah, Lamshman!
Shalom Aleichem!
These were jokes that the Fleischers put in there for the audience, and as a result, you know, there's a kind of underground appreciation of Betty Boop as a Jewish star of the early 30s.
There was rampant anti-Semitism in the 30s up until the war started. The moguls did not want to inflame the public, and they were trying to sell tickets to mostly white WASP and Catholic audiences.
It should be the duty of every citizen to demand of the sponsors of the large programs to stop feeding the public the trash of the Winchells, the Cantors, the Burns and Bernsteins, and give the American public for a change a voice which really speaks the American language without a Jewish accent.
That from a 1939 rally held in Madison Square Garden by the German-American Bund, a pro-Nazi organization.
They didn't want to draw attention to themselves as Jews because without them doing anything, Hollywood was attacked in the 20s by nativists as somehow not Christian, heathen, pagan. And they were certainly aware of that. And in the 30s, with the rise of Hitler in Europe and a general upsurge in anti-Semitism throughout the world, they were concerned both because they did a lot of business overseas and because they were told that they shouldn't make anti-Nazi films because this would inflame anti-Semites.
Sharon Rivo is executive director of the National Center for Jewish Film.
There's a whole thing going on in the 1930s, unfortunately, when the Jewish men who owned and controlled and ran those studios could have made a dramatic impact on America's knowledge, information, understanding about what was going on in Germany and in Europe to the Jews. They completely abrogated their responsibility.
In the late 1930s, Joseph P. Kennedy was America's ambassador to Great Britain, and he was much rumored to be anti-Semitic. He soon lost his job, and he came out to Hollywood at that point, and he gave one rather terrifying talk at a small private luncheon of all the Jewish moguls, and he said, "Listen, you've got to start toning down all this anti-Nazi stuff, because there is a war coming, and, well, we don't know how it's going to turn out, and we may very well end up being friends with Germany." Well, most of the moguls just sat there and took it. They were scared to death. There was real paranoia in this town.
Yes, Kennedy did go and meet with them and supposedly threaten them. Nevertheless, they had pretty much full control over what was happening in their studios. They simply were afraid.
I actually think that in some ways, Hollywood has gotten a bum rap about its activities in the 30s. They were under tremendous pressure to be docile Americans. The pressure came largely from their own Motion Picture Producers Association.
The Motion Picture Producers Association of America, or MPAA, was created by the moguls in reaction to organized pressure groups. The MPAA enforced a code which censored sex and blasphemy in the movies.
They didn't want to see movies like The Confessions of a Nazi Spy, which was the first real anti-Nazi movie. Warner Brothers made this in 1939.
Let us take a lesson from the deadly parallels of the Nazi Fifth Column activities abroad and here. America is not simply one of the remaining democracies. America is democracy. A democracy that has the God-given inspiration of free men, determined to defend forever the liberty which we have inherited in our Bill of Rights of the Constitution of the United States.
There were stink bombs and riots and pickets at theaters when this was shown in America. And right after that, the isolationists in the Senate opened an investigation to movies. Oh, the Jews are trying to drag us into a war. So the moguls maybe could have financed movies outside of the system. Who knows?
As late as 1941, when William Wyler was just starting to direct Mrs. Miniver, which was a real propaganda film trying to enlist American support and sympathy for the Brits, Louis B. Mayer came to William Wyler and said, "Look, you've got a Nazi in this movie. Soften him up a little. He doesn't have to be such a terrible Nazi, does he?" And William Wyler said, "Look, I've got one Nazi in my movie. I've got to make him the worst Nazi I possibly can." And Mayer said, "No, don't forget, you know, we still show our movies in Germany, and we're not at war with Germany, and so please soften it." As it happened, that conversation happened on the eve of Pearl Harbor. And the next day, Louis B. Mayer came in and said, "Make that Nazi as terrible as you want." And indeed he was. He's almost a cartoon of a Nazi in the final product.
"I'm finished. But others come. Like me. Thousands. We will bomb your cities."
"And thousands killed. Innocent people."
"Not innocent. They were against us."
"Women and children."
"We will do the same thing here. You've got no information, Eile."
The Great Dictator is the most direct assault on the Nazis that came out of Hollywood before the war, even though it's a comedy.
"Strange. These strike leaders, they're all brunettes, but a blonde amongst them."
Chaplin says that if he had really known what was going on, he could have never made that film.
"Brunettes are troublemakers. They're worse than the Jews. Wipe them out."
If you take a look at the dialogue, he actually discusses concentration camps, persecution of Jews.
"Too small. Not so fast. We get rid of the Jews first, then concentrate on the brunettes."
Almost as if he knew what was going on, but he didn't. And that's what's just so astounding when you look at that film today. It's almost as if he, not Roosevelt, knew and understood what was going on.
"We shall never have peace until we have a pure Aryan race. How wonderful. Tomania, a nation of blue-eyed blondes."
That movie was not received well.
Well, it did all right with audiences. Politically, it was attacked because here was an example of a movie being made, isolationist politicians said, to get us involved in a European war.
I always thought he was at least half Jewish, and it turns out that he's not. But the character of the tramp seemed to be quintessentially Jewish.
Part of it had to do with his physical appearance and also, you know, with his show business background. And then the fact that he made his reputation playing this character who, when he did triumph, triumphed through intelligence. And she never really denied it after a while, in part because he thought it would have been anti-Semitic to protest, no, 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 I'm not a Jew. But for the Nazis, he was a kind of negative poster boy. For them, Chaplin was the quintessential Jew. They put up a big anti-Semitic exhibit in Munich, and it was his image that presided over the whole thing.
There were hundreds of movies being turned out by the major studios in Hollywood during the 30s, and only two actually even dealt with Germany and the Nazis. Even after the war, after 1945, after the heads of the studios are taken to see the concentration camps and to see the dead bodies, there are still no films that deal with this.
In 1947, only 2 years after the war, Gentlemen's Agreement came out. It was one of the first films that dealt head-on with anti-Semitism. Gregory Peck plays a Gentile journalist who pretends to be a Jew.
I have a reservation, double room and bath, today through Thursday.
And try to register at fancy hotels, join country clubs.
In what name, please?
Green, Philip Green.
Yes, Mr. Green.
To experience and write about what it was like to be a Jew from the point of view of a WASP.
Is your hotel restricted?
Well, I'd hardly say it was restricted.
How do you do, Mr. Green?
How do you do?
In answer to your question, may I inquire, do you follow the Hebrew religion yourself? Or is it that you just want to make sure?
I've asked a simple question. I'd like to have a simple answer.
Gentleman's Agreement is produced by the one Gentile mogul, Darrell F. Zanuck, from Nebraska. He came out to Hollywood very early on, wrote the script such as they were for early Rin Tin Tin movies, quickly became a successful writer and then producer, started his own film company called 20th Century, and he quickly merged with the then failing Fox Company, and he created 20th Century Fox Films. And indeed, over the years, he proved to be one of the most ambitious and creative and courageous filmmakers in Hollywood.
Well, you see, we do have a very high-class clientele, and, well, naturally.
Then you do restrict your guests to Gentiles?
Well, I wouldn't say that, Mr. Green. But in any event, there seems to be some mistake because we don't have a free room in the entire hotel.
It was an extremely controversial move to make Gentleman's Agreement. It so filled these Jewish moguls with the fear of God that they allegedly went to Zanuck and offered to buy the negative off of him just so he would not release it. They had gone all this time, now 35 years, presenting movies as an all-American industry. Gentleman's Agreement turned out to be extremely sympathetic to the Jewish cause and was widely embraced by most of America. And it really is one of those landmark films that allowed the whole nation to take a moment and breathe and look at where we were on this particular issue.
Look, I'm Jewish and you don't take Jews. That's it, isn't it?
I never said that.
If you don't accept Jews, say so.
Don't raise your voice to me, Mr. Green. You speak a little more quietly, please.
Do you or don't you?
Mr. Green, I'm a very busy man. Now, if you want me to phone for a cab or room at the Brewster, I'll do so. Otherwise...
Otherwise what?
There actually was another movie which was rushed out by RKO a few months earlier, Crossfire. Kind of a tougher movie than Gentleman's Agreement because it's about a guy who kills a Jewish soldier just because he doesn't like Jews.
What'd you have to go after the guy for? Crime any money? Why'd you have to start in?
No Jew is going to tell me how to drink his stinking liquor.
It wasn't about being turned down by the country club or, you know, having your hotel reservations canceled, as in Gentleman's Agreement.
You have the two films that deal with anti-Semitism in 1947, Gentleman's Agreement and Crossfire. You have The Diary of Anne Frank, and that's pretty much it until 1965. the pawnbroker.
You were in a concentration camp, weren't you?
That's no concern of yours.
The flashbacks that Sidney Lumet did in Pawnbroker actually show for the first time in an American fiction feature film the concentration camps.
Come to Vistrasin. You better assure the sign.
Hollywood has always been about the bottom line. How do you make a film that deals with these kinds of issues? That's Hollywood entertainment. And I think it took a long time until Steven Spielberg picked the right vehicle in order to make a film that had the ability to reach the popular culture level. Part of the brilliance of Schindler's List is the selection of the material. Even though the backdrop is the horrific details of what's happening to the Jews during this period of time.
Women to the left! Men to the right! Women to the left!
The vehicle itself deals with two major German characters facing off against each other, and the ending is a relatively happy ending.
I could have got more out. I could have got more.
Oscar, there are 1,100 people who are alive because of you. Look at them. Generations because of what you did.
I didn't do enough.
You did so much.
You're listening to Over the Rainbow, part two of the story of the Jews who created Tin Pan Alley in Hollywood. I'm Larry Josephson. We'll be back in a minute.